Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
3 days, three press conferences. Barack Obama is laying it on heavy with his economic team. Smart people trying to solve difficult problems. But are they going to play nicely with each other? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, a holiday gift idea for people who love to eat, now available at splendidtable.org. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Great to have you with us on this Wednesday. It's the 26th of November. The president-elect had another press conference today at which he rolled out another group of economic advisors. The tall guy on the left side of the podium is the one we're interested in. Paul Volcker ran the Federal Reserve back in the Carter-Reagan days. That means he's been around for a while, a long while. We asked our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale to find out whether the 81-year-old Volcker can provide the fresh perspective that the president-elect says he's looking for.
Obama said he'll appoint innovative thinkers to the new Economic Recovery Advisory Board.
This is going to be designed to make sure that everybody, businesses across the board, whether it's high tech or manufacturing, old or new economy, labor, innovative thinkers who may not always subscribe to the conventional wisdom, that they are there to challenge some of our assumptions to make sure that we are not just doing the same old thing all the time.
The new panel's chairman, Paul Volcker, squeezed inflation out of the economy in the 1980s with tough monetary policies. Budget analyst Stanley Collender says the appointment of Volcker, former Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers, and New York Fed Chief Timothy Geithner to Obama's economic team means the president-elect plans to attack the economic mess from all sides.
You've got fiscal policy people, monetary policy people, Fed people. It shows they're going to try to be proactive. That is, rather than waiting for events to happen and responding to them, as the Bush administration seems to have done the last few months.
How will all these independent thinkers get together on policy? Andy LaPerriere follows Washington for the Wall Street research firm ISI.
The key, I think, is not how strong-willed those personalities are. It's more, once the president makes a decision, are people going to go out and carry out that decision? And I don't think that's a big worry.
The president-elect is expected to announce labor and commerce secretaries in the next few weeks. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
A funny thing happened on the way to the economic meltdown yesterday. Part of the bailout actually worked. After the Fed announced it's going to plow $800 billion into the consumer debt market, mortgage rates dropped, and they dropped pretty sharply, too. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports that set off a bit of a chain reaction.
Mortgage rates have been hovering above 6% for months, so even though home prices have dropped, many buyers had been holding back for a better interest rate, until yesterday, when the rate dropped to 5.5%.
They're calling immediately and saying, hey, I know rates have come down, are you going to be able to get that better rate?
That's Carlos Gutierrez, the president of CNC Mortgage in Minnetonka, Minnesota. He says buyers were in a better position to take advantage of the deal than those looking to refinance. And Holden Lewis of Bankrate.com says that's because many homeowners couldn't refinance right now, even if they tried.
They don't have good credit. They don't make enough money to repay the loan. Or more importantly, they owe more than the house is worth. Those folks, they're not going to be able to refinance.
And, of course, taking advantage of the low interest rate requires something else. Loan officer Ken Green in Cincinnati says you've got to pay close attention to the Fed's moves.
The average American isn't trained to understand what it means for mortgage rates when the Fed says they're going to inject $500 billion into Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They only find out about it, you know, this morning when they opened up the newspapers. And by then, mortgage rates had already retreated off their lows.
Rates, I'm sorry to say, are now back up around 6%, but analysts say they'll likely come down again when the Fed actually starts buying the mortgage-backed securities. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
This next one is a tough story to hear the day before Thanksgiving, but any day now the Agriculture Department is set to release its latest numbers on how many Americans are using food stamps, possibly 30 million or more. And as the economy gets worse, that figure is expected to keep on going up. Ashley Milne-Tite has more.
Janica San Roman works as a university researcher in Miami. This summer, her partner lost her job.
In mid-October, the couple applied for federal assistance and received food stamps.
I've always worked very hard and, you know, managed my money properly. I never expected that we would need to take advantage of a program like that.
Her partner just landed a new job, but many food stamp applicants aren't as lucky.
The number has been rising by a couple hundred thousand a month because of the recession.
That's Jim Weil of the Food Research and Action Center. He'd like Congress to approve a temporary boost in food stamp benefits. He says for one thing, they lag behind inflation, which is way up this year.
It's also great for the economy because when people get food stamps, they spend them right away because they're so desperately needy. And that works its way through the economy incredibly quickly.
He says the average food stamp benefit per person comes to $3 to $4 a day. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Granted, Wall Street doesn't really have much to be thankful for, except the past 4 days. It's been a 20% bounce, gang. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The North American International Auto Show got a little less international this week. Nissan's not going to show up in January for Detroit's hometown exhibition, trying to save cash, the company said. A lot of the glitz has been pared down, too. Somber is how one industry analyst described it, just not quite as much of a party as the industry is used to. Daron Levin's an editor-at-large for Bloomberg News in Detroit. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Give us a very quick taste of what car shows of the past have been like, would you?
In the old days, it used to be a lot of very attractive models in bathing suits. That kind of went away in the 90s, but there's still a lot of lights and theater and glitz and glamour. And so it's quite a spectacular event for the people who come to these shows.
And so these cutbacks that are happening this year, people not going and parties being smaller, do you think they're substantive or are they a bit more superficial?
They're actually substantive this year. Nissan shocked everybody when it said it wasn't going to come to the show and have any press conferences. One of the things that happens at all these shows is that there are usually 2 to 3 days of press previews before the show opens, and those are for CEOs and high company officials to come and give press conferences and show some of their products and talk about what the plans are for the coming year. And so those of us in the press who cover the automobile industry go to these shows in order not to just see the cars and trucks, but also to see these people.
What about the argument that in tough times, that's exactly when you should be getting in front of the customer? You should really be out there pumping new products and getting your message out. And aren't they sort of cutting off their nose to spite their face by cutting back on these car shows?
I think there's some logic in what they're doing. First of all, there's the cost. Of course, these things are very expensive. But then again, the economic demand for vehicles is quite weak right now. So by spending a lot of money on promotion and commercials, you really are not doing yourself a lot of good because people are just not in the mood to buy cars right now. That may change as credit gets better. That may change as the consumer mood gets better. But the fact is that nobody wants anybody's cars right now.
One thing you pointed out in your article this morning is that some of these companies don't actually have new products to get out there at the show.
That won't stop them from promoting them, though, Kai. And that happens regularly. We see a coupe that becomes a sedan. We see a red version of what was basically a green version. So there's sometimes there isn't a lot new, but there's always something to talk about, and they don't even want to do that because doing that is expensive as well.
There's a decent likelihood that Congress is going to be talking about a bailout just at the time this car show is going on, second week of January thereabouts. How much would a potential bailout change the attendance?
I don't think it's going to change the attendance, but it's certainly going to change what people are talking about. I can anticipate that if there is a great overlap between what's happening in Washington and what's happening in Detroit, that the attention of the people at the show is really going to be on what's going on in Washington, and it may detract from the press conferences that do take place.
Daron Levin covers Detroit for Bloomberg. Daron, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Detroit's problems come during interesting political times. The big three CEOs are due back in Washington next Tuesday. They're going to deliver the bailout justification that House and Senate leaders asked them for. Meanwhile, power within Congress is shifting. Advocates for the industrial economy are losing some of their clout. And commentator David Frum worries that could mean big changes for the big three.
While President-elect Barack Obama was collecting applause for his accomplished and centrist economic team, House Democrats were sending a very different kind of signal. The House Democratic Caucus has voted to eject John Dingell of Michigan from the chairmanship of the House Energy and Commerce Committee and to replace him with Henry Waxman of California. The 82-year-old Dingell is often thought of as the last New Dealer, a proud wearer of the union label, but also a staunch defender of gun rights. A leader on civil rights, but unpersuaded on global warming, Dingell was above all else the great congressional champion of industrial America. Waxman is literally the congressman from Hollywood. For him, environmental issues have always come first. As automakers beg for aid from Washington, the passage of the most powerful gavel in the House of Representatives to Waxman from Dingell signals a radical change of orientation. Speaker Pelosi has already spoken of making aid to the car industry conditional on a switch to high-mileage vehicles. New York Senator Chuck Schumer says of the auto industry's future, "We already know what that future is, the plug-in hybrid electric car." It's impressive that a career politician would be so certain of the future of an industry in which he never worked a day in his life. Observers used to distinguish between old Democrats like Dingell, who still believed in government control, and new Democrats who supposedly understood markets. But while Waxman may be a generation younger than Dingell, his thinking is no more modern. Waxman and his associates in Congress are just as ready to dictate and regulate and micromanage as the old New Deal wing. They just dictate and regulate and micromanage for very different purposes. Here's a market alternative. Raise gas taxes. Then let consumers and producers figure out for themselves how best to conserve. Maybe the answer will turn out to be as simple as smaller cars, closer neighborhoods, and more walking. Or maybe it will be as futuristic as personal space packs. We don't know. And since we don't know, we shouldn't be dictating to industry as if we did.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. His most recent book is called Comeback, Conservatism That Can Win Again. Send us your thoughts when you get a chance. Go to marketplace.org, click on that link that says Contact. There are some phrases you try to stay away from during times of economic crisis. Sometimes you can stay away, and sometimes you can't.
We need to think about belt tightening through all sectors of the economy.
Consumers tightening their belts.
Tighten that belt.
Tightening their belts.
Belt tightening.
Belt tightening.
And sometimes you hear some of them on this program. But is the industry that inspired that expression feeling the pinch? Marketplace's Sean Cole went to find out.
Cellar Leather is a modest little shop in Hyannis, Massachusetts. It's owned and run by Jeff Taylor, who was all alone behind the counter the day I visited.
Well, what you see when you first come in the door there is just a small sampling of some of the handmade belts, some without buckles, some with buckles.
Most of these belts are his own handiwork, 100% leather, no fillers, some with elaborate designs. Taylor's been making belts for more than 30 years. But in an age of such rampant belt tightening, is the humble belt maker adjusting his ways?
Have you had to punch more holes in your belt?
No, I haven't.
Have you had to make shorter belts?
It just depends on the person. You know, I have a lot of customers that come back that have lost weight and
really
need a belt made shorter. If it's a lot of weight loss, I can actually retool the belt from the other end of the belt, so you're not looking at an excessive amount of holes.
And what Taylor's dealing with on the retail side, David Sack is experiencing wholesale.
We're making shorter belts, that's for sure. And shorter belts are cheaper.
Sack is president and founder of a high-end line of belts called Streets Ahead.
We are also making skinnier belts.
It caters to the nation's chicest boutiques.
Most famous people wear our belts.
Really, most famous people?
I mean, from Angelina Jolie to Jennifer Aniston.
That is, most famous people who have been romantically linked with Brad Pitt.
That's just a coincidence.
But back to the issue at hand.
We punch on average of 5 holes in our belt.
Mm.
But if that is required by in the next month or two, we'll punch holes from the beginning of the tip to the end of the buckle. So you could actually use it as a dog leash if you want. Whatever it takes to survive.
To survive in a nation of narrowing waistlines.
Excuse me, guys. My name is Sean Cole. I'm with the public radio program.
All set today.
To measure the full circumference of the problem, I asked passersby on Boylston Street in Boston if they've been tightening their belts. Some understood the question instantly.
Yes, I've worked very hard so I could tighten my belt, take off a few extra pounds.
No, you just buy another belt.
You just buy another belt.
Yeah.
Strangely, some people thought I was talking about money.
It's important to not completely retract. Confidence in the market has a lot to do with people spending.
I think that's very wise and cogent. I am actually talking about your belt.
I think you need to expand your definition of belt tightening.
Really?
Yeah.
So I sought the counsel of Merrill Perlman, who writes the Language Corner column for the Columbia Journalism Review.
The first use that's related to the way we use it now is 1887 by Rudyard Kipling, according to the Oxford English Dictionary. I was once starved and tightened my belt on the sharp belly pinch.
Which is to say, Kipling got skinny first and then tightened his belt.
What's happened now is just the opposite. You tighten your belt before the deprivation.
But how do you tighten your belt before you've lost weight because you've starved? That's impossible.
That's why it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. A lot of these kinds of phrases don't make sense when you actually delve into them.
Still, the phrase belt tightening persists. And understandably, belt makers like Jeff Taylor hear it differently than you and I do.
Yeah, my mind just goes right to leather, right to making belts.
In Boston, I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
Craft beer's shining moment.
In the late 70s, President Jimmy Carter did the best thing that he did in his term. He signed the Cranston Act. He legalized the act of homebrewing.
That's coming up, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials lifted 247 points today, 2.9% to close at 87.26. The Nasdaq sprinted up 67 points, 4.6%, finished at 15.32. The S&P 500 gained 30 points, 3.5%, ended at 8.87. Deutsche Bank's view that the car companies have a better chance now of getting a federal bailout drove up car stocks. General Motors streaked ahead 35%. Ford accelerated nearly 30% today. A spurt in oil futures to more than $54 a barrel helped Exxon thicken up 3.5%. Chevron oozed up 4.5%. Engineering giant Fluor scalped up more than 14% today. Analysts predict the company will gain from some of that infrastructure spending President-elect Obama plans to push through Congress. The 10-year T-note gained some today. The price, that is. That means the yield slipped down to 2.98%. 2.98%. Think about that. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. What's the connection between Girl Scout cookies and margin calls? Check out the Marketplace Decoder on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's happening Thursday. U.S. markets are closed for the holiday. You'll have to obsess over the London or Australian or Asian exchanges. And after you pry yourself away from your portfolio, what else are you going to do? Most Americans watch TV. According to the Department of Labor, looking back at the last five Thanksgiving weekends, Americans spent a little over an hour per day preparing meals, and close to four are blobbed out in front of the tube. Balance, people. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every time you visit a new doctor for the first time, or open a credit card account, or take out a car loan, there's a pile of papers you have to sign. Usually there's a document buried deep in there someplace that you don't really read. It's called the arbitration agreement. When you sign it, you agree to go to arbitration instead of joining class action lawsuits. Arbitration doesn't always work out so well for consumers, so those agreements are being challenged in Congress and in the courts. And defending itself in court is exactly where American Express is going to be this coming Monday. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Ganser has more.
Okay, I admit it. I never read the fine print. And judging from an informal street survey in downtown Washington, many others don't either.
No, I don't read the fine print.
It's the same story. I don't read the fine print on a credit card, so...
Sergio Guito and Adam Nader are busy medical school students. They were surprised to learn that the fine print on their credit card bills may have committed them to arbitration. G.R. Homa reads every bit of the fine print. No wonder. He's an accountant in New Jersey. He checked up on American Express when the company promised him a cash rebate on his purchases and balance. Homa claims Amex didn't deliver what it promised. Attorney Paul Bland helped HOMA file a class action lawsuit.
There are lots of types of cases where companies will cheat large numbers of consumers, and the only meaningful, realistic remedy that their consumers would have would be to bring the case into class action.
But American Express said HOMA had to go to arbitration. A New Jersey court agreed. HOMA appealed. On Monday, a federal court in Philadelphia hears the case. Bland says if HOMA loses, it'll be the first step toward ending class action lawsuits nationwide, a big loss for consumers. He says arbitration isn't fair to consumers because companies usually appoint the arbitrators. So he says arbitrators have a strong incentive to rule in favor of those firms. American Express wouldn't comment for this story, but lawyers who support arbitration say it is fair and it's faster and cheaper for everyone. Philadelphia lawyer Alan Kaplinsky writes arbitration agreements for businesses. He says class action lawyers often get a big chunk of the money if they win.
A third to sometimes up to 40% of the recovery will go into the hands of the class action attorney and not to the consumer.
Kaplinsky says consumers are lucky to get a coupon from a class action. Arguments for and against arbitration are also being made on Capitol Hill. Congress is considering at least three bills that would prohibit corporations from forcing consumers into arbitration. Paul Bland says businesses have hired an army of lobbyists to kill those bills.
One person in a House office told me that there was a separate lobbyist assigned to each member of Congress to work on them to keep them from reforming the laws that relate to mandatory arbitration.
But if the lobbyist army can't hold the line and Congress passes the arbitration legislation, the court battles could be moot. Congress makes the laws of the land. Still, arbitration isn't exactly at the top of Congress's to-do list right now. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
A lot of you are probably on the road right now, bemoaning the traffic, but at the same time, looking forward to a nice holiday, hoping you can relax a little bit, watch some football, eat some turkey. Go ahead, have a beer or two as well, and a good one, please, not something watery. Author Brian Yeager's got a book out on the good ones, those smaller homegrown brews. I joined him for a cold one, or four, not too long ago, and to start, I asked him exactly what a craft beer is.
There are people who rigorously debate what is a craft beer? And generally, they will tell you that it is an independent company, or at least one that is majority owned by the founders or by someone, because in this day and age, there are so many levels of ownership. Sometimes a smaller craft brewery could actually have a minority ownership from one of the larger breweries.
Oh, now how distressing is that to find out?
It's a question of survival, really. Sometimes the owners have discovered that in order to get into the marketplace, to get onto the shelves, they need to be delivered by the trucks with those bigger logos. But usually a strict minority interest will keep the craft beer considered independent. Of course, anything that is still only found in, say, Bisbee, Arizona, I would even argue not just a microbrewery, it's a nanobrewery. It's tiny.
All right. Well, we are actually in a bar, not a brew pub, not a brewery, but a bar. And so what we're going to do is we're actually just going to order some beers. And I'm going to actually leave it to you, since you're the beer guy.
I love it.
To figure out what we should have.
I'll make four selections here. For dark, we have to go Old Rasputin Russian Imperial Stout. For IPA, we have to go Racer 5 IPA. We could always go for the Craftsman 1903 Lager, which is a lager, but more flavorful.
Yeah.
And for something a little milder, shall we say, I see Amstel Light on the menu.
Tell me about the jump some of these family enterprises make from avocation, that is basically doing it in the garage, to occupation and eventually a real business.
You really saw that trend start in the late 70s. President Jimmy Carter did the best thing that he did in his term. He signed the Cranston Act. He legalized the act of homebrewing. So there were people who lived all over the country, and they were doing this. It was contraband. They were making their own beer in their garages.
Moonshine almost,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. And they thought, well, wait a minute. Now that I'm allowed to do this, what if I turn my avocation into a vocation? And thank God they did, because from that we got Sierra Nevada. We got the Widmer brothers, who are now one of the biggest craft breweries, but they started out as home brewers.
So let's have a sip of the stout here.
Oh, that's good.
There's nothing like a beer after a day like we've been having.
You should know that
in the markets.
This is an imperial stout. That just means bigger than your usual stout. It's higher in alcohol. It'll get you.
Oh, perfect. That's just what I need. Clearly, the economy's having some problems. Disposable income is at a premium. What's that going to do to the craft beer sector when these good beers that we've been drinking cost $3, $4, $5 more than a six-pack of Bud Light?
I could tell you that just for the numbers for 2007, the craft beer segment actually climbed 12%. And that is actually an improvement from a decline a couple years ago. Even though people may have less money to spend, it's just a luxury in a bottle, and it's not going to set you back a whole lot.
Do you see the big three, that is Miller and Anheuser-Busch and Coors?
Miller and Coors actually merged, so you could technically say the big two.
The big two, right? And I've been seeing lately on television some of those brewers coming out with more craft brew seeming concoctions. You know, they're slightly darker, different labels and all that stuff. Are they really aware of craft brews as a competitive threat, or is it just they want to appeal to that audience?
I actually think that it may come back to bite them. They might turn on people who are Budweiser diehards and let them realize that there is a better tasting beer out there, and they're going to use Budweiser Ale as a gateway beer, so to speak, to the world of better craft beers.
The book by Brian Yeager is called Red, White, and Brew. Brian, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, I think I've mentioned a couple of times that we get a decent number of listener emails that say we are too negative about the economy. Got one just today, in fact. I'd offer the defense that we're telling you what happens, we're not making it up, but some banks in San Francisco's financial district have apparently had enough of the gloom and doom. The San Francisco Chronicle's website says today that some of them have flipped from CNN or CNBC to the Food Channel, at least through Thanksgiving, one bank exec said, so they got another day or so. That is Marketplace from American Public Media on this day before Thanksgiving 2008. Today, the Dow rose 247 points, 2.9%. The Nasdaq jumped up 67 points, 4.6%. The S&P 500 gained 30 points, 3.5%. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, trust funds with a catch.
I'm aware of one incentive trust in which the beneficiary's weight was taken into consideration. If she weighed more than a specified amount, the income from the trust would be cut back.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. If you get the day off tomorrow, enjoy it. If not, we'll be here.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.